With this he projected a small but brilliant flash which immediately arrested their attention. Marie's face positively beamed with pleasure as she recognized who was calling her, and, relinquishing her embrace of Azina, she ran towards us and greeted Kushner with all the affection of a daughter. My presence was forgotten in those first moments of reunion, not being at all necessary to their happiness, and since there is no formality of introduction demanded in this life, I joined Azina and left Kushner to make all necessary explanations then call for me when he desired my company. I was surprised to find how free and unrestrained our intercourse was from the moment we met. Turning from our friends, we walked my mutual consent towards the point at which they were standing when Kushner called them. As we did so I asked, "Does this place seem dull and gloomy to you in comparison with your own home?" "Dull," she exclaimed, her face suffused with the brightness of her smile. "No, no, anything but that. Heaven consists in condition more than locality, and to have a share in driving the clouds from poor Marie's life is quite sufficient to turn any place into a heaven." I was silenced, for it was by no means difficult to conceive that heaven would always be found closely attendant upon such a companion, and I could appreciate the benefits to be derived from silent communication such as Marie was indulging in when we first saw them. The music of her laughter would soon prove fatal to melancholy, and before the brightness of her eyes the clouds of sorrow be compelled to disappear. With the slight knowledge I possessed of the law of procedure here, I could easily understand her attendance and ministry upon Marie. It was another example of the unvarying and perfect fitness of every detail of this life to its requirement and necessity. What could be more apposite than that this poor, wounded, crushed soul, that it was occasioned by her own sin does not alter the fact, should be entrusted to the tender and patient care of a nurse whom a painter would solicit from the gallery of dreams to sit as a model of charity. If throughout eternity, heaven did no more than knit such hearts together in the close affection I had witnessed, it would, well, that would make it heaven. I am anxious to see the view which Kushner tells me may be had from the bottom of the grounds, I remarked presently.
"Yes. You must see that," she replied. "It is just like the dear old Dr. Grandpa to find this place for Marie." "I don't think that he has much the appearance of a grandfather," I said. "Though every inch of him is a doctor. Yet there was something about him in spite of his youthful visage which told me that that dual epithet was the most comprehensive and correct one which could be applied to him. He had been an unsolved enigma from the moment I first met him, and the idea of obtaining a further insight into the character which had so perplexed me was a very welcome one." "No," she responded. "He scarcely looks old enough, does he?" "But that is by no means due to his lack of years, it must rather be ascribed to the eternal youth we enjoy. When he came into this life he was both a grandpa and a doctor, and though he has grown so very youthful in his form and bearing, we are compelled to give him his double cognomen or we should only refer to half of what he is even now."
"Has he been here long?"
"Yes. He lived in the early days of Egypt. I think it was prior to the building of the pyramids."
"And does he remember his earth life?"
"I do not think he has forgotten a single incident either in his earth or present life, if he will give himself a moment to recall it. One of the things which makes him like a grandpa still is the delight he finds in gathering a number of us together and recounting episodes from his own experience for our instruction and amusement. He is, I think, the most unselfish man I ever met, having no thought for himself, but only existing to augment the happiness of everyone with whom he comes in contact. Always planning new pleasures and surprises, when he introduces them he does it in a kind of apologetic tone, as though he had committed some offense and was about to ask for pardon, and when he sees the additional happiness invariably resulting from his labors, he himself is quite happy, first in sympathy with those whom he has made so glad, and then, again, that he has been the means of such enjoyment. Why, now, let me tell you how it is that Marie is here. He met her first on the other side of the mists."
"Has he told you?"
"Yes, he told me how and where he met her. But he has not told you how long and difficult was his work before he could induce her to listen to him, of the conflict he had with malignant spirits who delighted in her torture and tried to frustrate all his endeavors. You know nothing of his many failures to make her come away from such horrible surroundings, if only for a space, to prove that no one but herself stood in the way of her peace, since the legitimate penalty of her sin had been paid. No one but himself knows the extent of this, and no one ever will, for it is buried with a thousand similar secrets in the oblivion of his own breast, never to be willingly recalled or thought of again. I have heard something of this from Marie. But, poor child, her memory of that period is happily overcast, though she has told me enough to show the struggle was a fierce one, and the reward of it will, by and by, be not the least of the bright jewels which will sparkle in his diadem. When at length he accomplished his object, he gained permission to carry her to his own home, where he could watch her as she slept through the prostration that succeeded her suffering, and while she slept he could scarcely be persuaded to leave her side, lest even in her sleep she should feel his absence and be lonely. Such devotion had its reward, and was powerful in removing much of her weight of trouble. His determination to make her happy won her confidence first, then her love, and finally was the means of enabling him to be the minister of her salvation. It is very pathetic to hear Marie speak of her waking, and Kushner's tender but compulsory announcement that he would take her to her own home where she would be better for a time than even where she was. She was full of fear that if he left her she would be drawn back to the agony of the past, and pleaded long and tearfully to be allowed to stay. That could not be, and so he did the next best thing to it. Knowing she must be located here for a time, he searched the district till he found this house, which affords, from this point, the view of which he spoke. This lovely valley is an incessant theme of admiration for her, and on the hillside in the far away, but yet distinctly visible in the glory, light which plays upon it, stands Kushner's house, her other home, as she always calls it, and she delights to stand here talking of him, and watching for his coming, as he generally does, straight across. The beautiful panorama unrolled before me, the circumstances we were discussing, and the close proximity of two of the chief actors in the thrilling drama, filled me too full for speech. I could only contemplate how each succeeding incident in my career bore ever stronger testimony to that law of love which is the mainspring of this life. At the time Kushner called us, she continued, after a moment's pause, we were looking at his home, which Marie considers the central feature of the landscape, and she was wondering, how long do you intend to keep her waiting? We turned to find Kushner had stolen upon us unobserved. How much of our conversation had been heard we had no idea, but his next sentence told us that he well knew what its drift had been. Azina, he said, I am sadly afraid that you are a little telltale, and I shall be compelled to administer some correction to you. You are a good, dear old grand Pa, and deserve to be kissed for listening. There, there, she cried, as she threw her arms around him and saluted him on either cheek. Oh, these children! He replied, as he shook his head at her in mock gravity, and then, turning to me, he said, I think you had better go and keep Marie company while I give this child a scolding. Why, you dear old darling, you would not know how to begin if you tried, were the last words I heard as I turned away. I was glad to be able to hear Marie's story from her own lips, but as I neared her and saw her face darken by the shadow of some approaching agony, so changed from its brightness as she greeted Kushner, I would have gladly foregone the recital, if by that means I could have witnessed a return of her former happiness. But again I was impelled by that mysterious influence which operates, to carry us over points of difficulty and uncertainty, always in the right direction, even though opposed to inclination and understanding for the time being. In spite of the consequences, I knew it was best to go forward and leave to Kushner's future explanation whatever might transpire of an incomprehensible nature. I had already learned so much of the development of blessings from the most apparent improbabilities as to feel confident that all things worked together for good, and began to watch for the manifestation of all kinds of surprises in every new feature of the life as it was presented to me. As Marie came towards me, I was conscious of the effort she exerted to overcome the premonition which so visibly enveloped her, and the unsuccessful attempt she made to greet me with a smile which died in its birth, throb, but I knew that my own face only too faithfully represented my feelings at the moment, So our interview commenced with a greeting signally ominous of its tragic termination. Kushner had made all necessary explanations as to the object of my visit, and so, with very few preliminaries, Marie proceeded to give me her experiences as follows. I am an American, the only child of a southern millionaire idolized by my parents, and pampered, proud and willful from my infancy. When I wished for anything I only had to speak and it was mine. My education, both by practice and by precept, taught me that money was almighty, and as its supply to us was practically unlimited, I grew up with the idea that I was to be obeyed, and no wish I cherished or expressed could ever be thwarted. Of course this tended to make me very exacting, even overbearing, but I was by no means cruel or wicked as the world would judge. Having the money I had a right to all the pleasure it would bring, and if my enjoyment was unfortunately the cause of pain to another, I was not to be blamed for that, it was their misfortune, and they had no right to expect me to forego my desire out of consideration to their feelings. Such was my philosophy, and I acted upon it. We were church people, my father always liberally contributing to the various agencies promoted therefrom, punctilious in our attendance at the services, my name being duly enrolled as a member upon reaching the appointed age. Whenever I felt inclined or desired an excuse for breaking an irksome engagement, I would take a class in the Sunday school, or find it necessary to pay a charitable visit. It was not often, I allow, but as I looked upon it as an act of condescension upon my part to do such work at all, it was not to be expected that I should be anything like regular in my attention to those duties. There was never but one girl I could really call my friend, that was Sadie Norton. Our social position was fairly equal, but I being a trifle the older of the two, could rightfully assume the premier place. Then Sadie was not exactly the girl to command or lead, so I was in no way interfered with in my assumption of leadership, and for that reason our companionship became a very close one. A friendly rivalry existing between our parents was to some extent reflected by us, but without lessening the sisterly feeling which had been engendered, and rather strengthened than otherwise, with years. We were always together, and no festival, sociable, at home, or surprise party was considered complete unless we were present. Upon every scheme put forward at the church we were consulted, every philanthropic object sought our patronage, and before we were out of our teens every eligible fellow in the town and country was angling to catch us. This latter fact opened an avenue for a great increase of our fun, not that we thought of marrying, for a moment, but we very seriously interfered with many others who did, and for a year or two were perfectly enraptured at the number of matches we were enabled to break off. Presently a fine young fellow came along, bringing very satisfactory credentials to my father and others, and all the girls in the town set their caps at him. Sadie and myself determined to go for him as well, and by playing him, alternately, keep him from anyone else, as well as give him a teasing. But he took matters in a most awfully serious light, and before a month had passed made me a formal proposal. I must confess that I too felt very serious about the matter, and would have accepted him if that would not have ended the romance we had determined to enjoy. So I laughed at him, and when he enlisted my mother's aid, I stood on my dignity, and very cavalierly told him I was not of the marrying kind. He went away looking very crestfallen, but I laughed. My experience of men had not been a long one, but I knew his cloud would only last till sunrise. Every man enters upon the April season of his life when he falls in love, and the way he is treated and trained by the woman he woos, at such a time, has much to do with the formation of his permanent character. So I thought, and therefore determined to give him such a schooling as would bring him out the hero into whose keeping I would entrust myself, so far as I deemed prudent. I made a mistake. The morrow came, but brought no Charlie. I was piqued. He was trying for the mastery, but he would find his match. A week passed and I did not see him. Neither did Sadie, for I had prepared her in case he should try the effect of flirtation. A month went by without a sign of him. Circumstances had also prevented me seeing much of my friend. Then we met. It was at Sadie's birthday party, and the first thing she told me was that Charlie had proposed. My face lighted with the anticipation of the fun we should have presently. She continued that she had accepted him. The blood rushed back to my heart. I stood speechless as a statue. In a moment my blood boiled and dashed through my veins in cataracts of maddened fury. Jealousy and disappointed love devoured me, my brain reeled under the strain. I fell, and remember no more. The day they were married I was swinging in the balances of life and death, from brain fever. All through my delirium their names were seldom off my tongue, pleading, entreating, or cursing them, as the frenzy impelled me. But after my reason returned I had strength of mind never to mention them again. The magic potency of wealth was pressed into service in every conceivable form to wean my thoughts from my sorrow, and so skillfully did I play the part I had arranged in the early days of convalescence, that everyone was presently congratulating themselves on matters not really being so serious as was at first imagined. They little dreamed my composure was but a mask and that in my soul I was plotting and planning how to best obtain the revenge which I would either secure, or die in the attempt. Sadie had been false, had taken advantage of our temporary estrangement to carry her base design to success, and she had succeeded with fatal effect. She had deceived Charlie as wickedly as she had injured me, for it was impossible she could be the wife I should have made him. He was not so much to be blamed since he had been made the tool of her cunning duplicity. But she should feel the weight of my vengeance. I would find them if I had to travel the world in my quest. I would return her perfidy fourfold, and take him from her even if I died in the hour of my triumph. For 5 years I continued my secret but unsuccessful inquiries, but I never for one moment faltered or forgot my vow. So perfectly did I hide my jealousy that my acquaintances began to think I was really happy again. How little we know of the man, while we rapturously applaud the actor, the stage and the home have not infrequently a gulf between them quite as impassable as the division between Dives and Lazarus, and we poor simpering mortals laugh at the memorized lines, but have no eyes or ears for the lifeblood which gurgles from the heart meanwhile. I was deaf and blind to everything but the one object of my life. They thought me happy, while there was nothing in earth or heaven could make me so but the man I had lost, and who had been stolen from me by the base ingratitude of my seeming friend. Accident discovered his whereabouts, a small paragraph in an old newspaper, from which I was cutting a pattern. I saw his name, learned all that was necessary, and at once began to formulate a plan for reaching him. Life from that moment assumed something of a hopeful hue, but my excitement very nearly ruined everything. I would to God that it had done so. Having found him, it was easy to go to him, since an old college friend was living in the same place, and to arrange to pay her a visit was only a matter of a few days. My next step was more difficult, as everything depended upon our first interview. One rash or false move and all would be lost. But even here fortune, or, as I know it now, misfortune, favored me. I met him accidentally, and alone. He recognized me, and spoke before I was aware of his presence. I saw his agitation, knew his old love was not dead, but by an almost superhuman effort I preserved a seemingly indifferent calmness even when I asked after his wife. I read volumes in his reply. He had discovered his mistake, was not happy, and the assurance of it made me frantic with delight. He was mine, I knew it, if only I acted with caution, kept my hand concealed, and waited an appropriate opportunity. We met several times after the same fashion, but he never once visited me, or invited me to his house. Presently he asked me to keep a clandestine appointment. I refused. He urged it for the sake of Auld Lang Syne. Finally I consented. I was lost. But that was the price I had calculated to pay if I could win him, and I had done it. In less than a month his wife and children were deserted, and we were flying east. I was happy now that I had repaid Sadie's deceit in her own coin. I could never be Charlie's wife, but that was nothing. I was his, he was mine, and my account with my arrival was square. We were together and alone, that was all I had craved for, and my revengeful prayer had been answered. In my rebellion God stood aside and let me gather all the necessities for a heaven of my own design, and when the work was finished, he bade me enter. Then, lo! I found my heaven to be God's exquisite and perfect hell. Having accomplished my desire and the tension under which I had lived so long being over, A speedy collapse ensued. I had never really recovered from my first blow, but my craving for revenge had given me strength which was only obtained by heavy drafts upon my constitution. No sooner had I attained my wish, and the necessity for duplicity over, than the tax upon my vitality put in its claim, and it was evident that I had but a short future before me. In less than 2 years I was a confirmed invalid, unable to move, while we were compelled to face the awful fact that I was dying. At this time my father found me, and reproaching me for the dishonor I had brought upon his name, vowed if ever Charlie crossed his path he would shoot him like a dog. I pleaded with him, but he was inexorable, told me Charlie had left me as he had left his wife, that he had quitted the town, had gone no one knew where, and that it was impossible I could ever see him again. All the old jealous fury came back at this, followed by brain fever, then delirium, and finally a blank. When I awoke it was dark, horribly dark, I could almost touch the blackness, and I was lying upon a bare floor, cold as a block of ice. I called Charlie, my father, my nurse. But there was no response save the echo of my own voice, which seemed to mock and rejoice at the terror I felt creeping over me. Where was I? Great God! Could it be possible that I had gone mad, or that I had been placed under restraints to keep me from following Charlie? I rose to make what inspection was possible of my surroundings, under the circumstances, but in the ague of my fear I fell without the strength to rise. All my senses resolved themselves into the power of feeling, quickened and intensified a hundredfold that I might contemplate with horror the process of my own petrifaction, voiceless, sightless, sleepless. How I prayed for the fever and delirium to return and conquered the icy terror which crept so slowly, so agonizingly over me. Vain prayer. I was a prisoner in the rigid domain of despair, beyond the reach of help, or rest, or pity, the sportive toy of all the remorseless machinations which are germane to such a state. I was being slowly converted into a block of frozen, yet living, flesh, and my abnormal sense of feeling heightened as the infernal transformation went on. Why was it? Where was I? Who were my relentless persecutors? How long before the morning would break? Would the day bring me relief, or wake me from the agonizing dream? These, and a thousand other queries, propounded their unending enigmas for my additional punishment, till I would gladly have rushed into the arms of madness for rest, but alas, I was deprived of even such a consolation. At length my feet, my hands, my head, my eyes, my tongue, my heart, my brain were ice-bound. Then the furies boiled in my blood, and lashing it into angry foam by its excessive heat, sent it in maddened cataracts through my veins to finish the exquisite suffering, which I must needs lie still and bear. Of the termination of that period I have no recollection. Whether I suffered until pain wearied itself out in the intoxication of its own excesses, or whether the intensity of my torture became an anesthetic and lulled me into the sleep of agony, remains a mystery. I only know that for a space my existence lay in oblivion, but of its duration and nature I cannot say anything. When my memory again took up the thread of life I was still in the same state of semi-palpable blackness amid a silence which terrified me to listen to. But the sharp agony of my suffering was over, or, rather, I should say, a respite had been granted while the nature of my torment was being changed to one, if possible, of a more agonizing description. I was still ignorant of my whereabouts, or of the character of the great change that had really taken place in my career, though I was quite conscious I had gained strength, was free from actual pain and had acquired the power to move if I desired to do so. I also quickly recognized how incalculably my condition had improved from that which immediately preceded my period of unconsciousness, but I yearned for some degree of light, either natural or artificial, that I might discover my surroundings and make some guesses as to what had taken place, as well as estimate the difficulties to be contended with. The duration of this suspense, in which my only companions were the fantastic shadows of the subterranean gloom, was too long for me to appraise. It seemed to be centuries, but I know now that such could not be. But at length, oh, such a length I had my wish partly gratified. I saw a light, but it was so small and far away as to be useless for my purpose. No sooner did I observe it than I was conscious of an involuntary movement as if was being irresistibly drawn in that direction. At first I experienced an almost imperceptible gliding sensation, gradually increasing in velocity until I was carried from my feet and borne rushing through space as upon the wings of a hurricane. On and on, league after league, with an ever increasing momentum towards that magnetic beacon which, expanding as I travelled, yet appeared to be as far away as ever. Oh! The fear and suspense with which that aerial voyage filled me. It was not the pain of my previous punishment, but the dread of the consequences which might result, and I was powerless to avert, was almost as terrible in its effects. Suddenly the power by which I had been attracted or impelled, seemed to be exhausted, and I fell, scared but unhurt, upon the threshold of that light to find it radiated around the only person for whose presence I sighed, and wept, and groaned. It was Charlie. I had found him, was with him again. Something told me that the force by which I had been carried hither, reluctantly in my ignorance, was by some means connected with his intense desire to see me, and in my new, found happiness at our reunion. I wept and reproached myself for the hard thoughts I had so willingly entertained against the unknown benefactor who had come to my relief, released me from my prison house, and so brought us together again in spite of my father's strategy and opposition. Then another something dashed my hopes by suggesting that what I saw was only an hallucination, the cruel vagaries of a dream, and that I should presently wake to find my father as inexorable as ever, and Charlie gone I knew not whither. The thought that such a development might be realized was an unbearable one. The shadow of such a suspicion could not be allowed to rest upon me for a moment. I would take measures to resolve the doubt at once. I passed into the circle of light which enveloped him. How much he had changed since we parted. His jet black hair was profusely lined with silver. The once calm face was furrowed, the brightness of his eyes was dimmed, and his stalwart form was bowed. At the moment he was thinking of me, and I was conscious of his having passed through an ordeal almost as fierce as that I had been compelled to bear. As I reached his side he murmured my name, while his hand moved as if to make an attempt to take my own, but lost in the depth of his reverie, perhaps unsuspecting that I was so near. He did not raise his eyes to meet my hungry gaze, which was feasting upon the sight of his presence. Oh! How happy I felt! His tone and manner revealed to me he loved me as much as ever, and made me fearful to put my project into execution, lest the result should prove unpropitious. He had not returned to Sadie, but driven from my side had found this retreat, where it was by no means troubled me or excited my curiosity, where he had perfected a plan for my deliverance, and was he not lost in abstraction, as he nervously awaited the result, so lost that he little knew what success had been accomplished. I lifted my head and saw that the far-away look had not faded from his eyes, in which I noticed a strangely suspicious light was beaming. I started to my feet in horror, and shook him, in my fear that the joy of our reunion had proved too much, and that his reason had deserted him. He only shivered as if the room had grown chilly. Then I questioned my own sanity. Could it be possible my mysterious journey had been the delirium of a mad woman's raving? Oh! God! I cried, reveal this mystery, or it will kill me. Charlie, Charlie! Don't you know me? Speak but one word, and tell me so. I have been ill, but I have never swerved in my love for you. If you think I have done wrong, oh! My love! Forgive me, and let me nurse you back again to health. We will be happy yet. Come, let us go away. Say you know me, and I will be content, Charlie. Just one word, dear, say you know me. At this he roused himself abruptly, picked up a book, and began to read without so much as a word, a look, or a sign that he recognized my presence. I recoiled in amazement, dumbfounded. He was not mad. But how could I account for this warrantable treatment? Why would he not speak? Surely if my presence was unwelcome, he would tell me so. If he feared the discovery, he would take means to conceal me. If I was still the same to him as before, he would clasp me in his arms, and greet me. Anyhow, I could not account for my reception except upon the basis of that cruel suggestion, that I was only the victim of a dream. God knows my suffering was real. Whether anything else would prove so should be presently determined, for I would watch and wait.